And that will suffice. It's not necessary for him to do, to give the qada of the prayers. So I should say that Ayatollah Sistani's fatwa is very different from the fatwa of other religious authorities when it comes to mustahab ghusl, you know. Ayatollah, many religious scholars, as far as I know, are of the view that ghusl janaba, which is obligatory, is sufficient for wudu, and there's no need for wudu. Other types of ghusl, like ghusl istihaza, ghusl jum'ah, and other types of ghusl are not sufficient, and therefore wudu is required after ghusl. But Ayatollah Sistani is of the view that all wajib ghusl, all obligatory ghusl, and all recommended ghusl, mustahab ghusl, which are proved to be mustahab in Islamic Sharia, they are sufficient for wudu, and wudu is not required after performing those types of ghusl.
That's interesting. Yes. That's interesting. Okay, if a person is performing the ghusl janabat, by way of immersion, or itimas.
Okay.
Does he have to say that I performed this ghusl or the janaba ghusl by way of immersion, or simply saying the expression I performed the ghusl is enough?
Well, niyyah or intention is a matter of the heart, okay, the mind, okay. It's not. It has nothing to do with the tongue. Okay, it's not necessary to express your niya or to say it verbally. Okay, to just pass it through your mind and have that intention that you are going to perform ghusli irtimasi or ghusli, you see, tartibi, is sufficient. Okay, and God knows the truth. He is aware of what we are doing. Therefore, if you have it in your mind, that's sufficient. It's not necessary to verbally say it. Okay, if you want to say it, it's okay. You can verbally recite and utter the niyyah, but that's not a necessary condition for the validity of wudu. And of course, ghusli irtimasi is very different from ghusli tartibi, because one is done in the proper order. You wash your head and neck, and then the right side of the body, and then the left side. But as far as this ghusl by way of immersion is concerned, of course you have to last just like diving in underwater. You have to immerse your head, your body, all parts of your body, in an instant underwater, so that water covers all parts of your body in an instant. That's called ghusl irtimasi.
The office of Ayatollah Sistani is currently providing the following services: 1. Board of Istifta, replying to religious questions. 2. Helping the poor, needy, homeless, and those who have suffered losses by earthquakes and floods. 3. Sending books for people who want to understand and learn Islam. 4. Hajj delegation. 5. Sending preachers. Board of Istifta is a link between Ayatollah Sistani and people. It provides them with answers to questions pertaining to religious, ideological, social, and educational matters in accordance with the verdicts and rulings of Ayatollah Sistani. For more information, visit the website of Ayatollah Sistani at www.sistani.org. You can also ask your questions through the following email: english@sistani.org.
Is there, Sheikh, any kind of preference over which ghusl, either by way of immersion or sequential ghusl? Is there any kind of preference here by Sharia, by the Islamic laws, or by Ayatollah Sistani? For example, if can a person perform ghusl irtimasi instead of ghusl tartibi to save time? Even if he has enough time, can he do the same thing?
Well, as far as I know, as far as I have read Ayatollah Sistani's fatwa, there isn't any preference. You know, both form of ghusl, whichever is convenient. For example, sometimes, for example, you do not have enough water. You have just a bucket of water, and that bucket of water you cannot immerse your head or body in it. So in that case, you have no option, you have no choice other than using the sequential ghusl or doing ghusl by way of sequence. And as far as irtimas is concerned, or ghusl by way of immersion is concerned, you should have a lot of water. Of course, you can dive in a river or maybe in a sea of water, and then that's sufficient. So there is no preference. There is none of them is better than the other. Both ways are allowed and permissible.
Sheikh Javid, what about ink? Is the ink a kind of barrier, especially when it dries out on the skin, to perform the wudu or ghusl?
Ayatollah Sistani is of the view that ink, it depends on the type of ink. You know, you cannot just say that okay, ink of any type does not form any barrier. You know, some inks may form a kind of barrier. It may obstruct water.
Mm-hmm.
If you are not sure that water reaches your skin.
Mm-hmm.
You have to make sure that water reaches your skin, okay? So how can you make sure that water reaches your skin? You have to remove the ink, okay? Remove the ink. So if you use soap to remove it, because if sometimes it is oily, and that oil may keep the ink on your body, on your finger, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to use something to remove it. But as far as the color, the dye is concerned, of course, that does not form any kind of barrier. And just like henna, for example, we have a lot of ladies in, let's say, in the Indian subcontinent use henna.
Mm-hmm.
Or mehndi, and then they apply it after applying the henna, they just wash it and remove the henna. The color remains on the skin. So that color does not form any kind of barrier. It can be, you see, and it will not affect any the prayer, the wudu, the ghusl, will remain perfect, it will remain in order.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. That was the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ocean of Dua.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarisi with you with another edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. In this edition of the program, we'll have a glance at Kumail's supplication and we'll discuss a commentary on that. We'll be back in a few seconds, so stay tuned.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد اللهم إني أسألك برحمتك التي وسعت كل شيء وبقوتك التي قهرت بها كل شيء شيء وخضع لها كل شيء.
Brothers and sisters, regarding the very first phrase of this dua, Allahumma inni as'aluka bi rahmatika allati wasi'at kull shay. O Allah, I ask you by your mercy that envelops everything. We have talked about numerous things. In the previous program, we started talking about the stories of Almighty Allah's mercy. There remain a couple of more stories to recite and tell in this program. Among them is this, that in the time of Mansur bin Ammar, who was among the Gnostics, in that time, a rich man decided to organize a sinful sermon. So he gave his servant 4 drachmas, which is a unit of money used in Greece before euro was invented. So anyway, he sent his servant to the market to buy food for serving the guests. When going to the market, the servant passed by the assembly of Mansur bin Ammar and said to himself, I'd better stand here and listen to what Mansur ibn Ammar says. He heard Mansur asking help for a poor from the assembly, saying, who will give me 4 drachmas so that I will ask 4 things for him from Allah? The servant of the rich man thought to himself, it is better to give the money to Mansur and benefit from his prayer, rather than buying food and drinks for the sinners with this money that will arrive to my masters at this night. So the servant gave the money to Mansur and said, ask 4 things for me from Allah. Mansur said, what would you like me to ask for you from Allah? The servant replied, first, I'd like you to ask the Almighty Allah to free me from the slavery of my master. Second, ask him to make my master regretful. Third, that he return his 4 drachmas to me in some way. And fourth, that the Almighty Allah forgive my sin and that of him, his servants, and his guests altogether. Anyway, Mansur prayed for the servant and he returned to his master without buying anything. The rich man asked his servant, where were you? The servant replied, oh my master, I gave 4 drachmas and bought 4 prayers. The rich man asked about the 4 prayers. The servant said in reply, I asked him that first he make me free from this slavery, then I asked him to make you free in the Almighty Allah's path, and that you may have the chance to repent, and that Allah forgive all our sins. The rich man gave him another 4 drachmas. And about the 4th request, asking the Almighty Allah to forgive him and his guests, the master said, I did what I could, but this last one is beyond my ability. At night, the master dreamed of Allah revealing to him, O servant, you did your duty out of mercy, though you are very poor indeed. It is beyond our infinite mercy that we do not do our duty. Thus, we forgave you, we forgave your servant, and all those present in your gathering. Now you can see the embracing of the Almighty Allah's mercy in all these anecdotes and all these hadiths.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Oh Allah, bless Muhammad and his progeny. Oh Allah, I beseech you by your mercy which encompasses everything, and by your power by which you overcome everything and which submits to it everything and humble before it is everything.
and by your might by which you conquer everything, and by your majesty against which nothing can stand, and by your greatness which prevails over everything, and by your authority which is exercised over everything, and by your own self that shall endure forever after everything has vanished, and by your names which manifest your power over everything, and by your knowledge which pervades everything, and by the light of your face which illuminates everything. O he who is light, O he most holy, O he who is light, O he most holy.
There is another story about a wise man who was crossing a road, and he suddenly happened to look at a group of people expelling a young man from town. They said that we are expelling him because of his corruptions. A woman who was weeping uncontrollably followed them, and the wise man asked about the woman and found that she was the young man's mother. The wise man pitied the mother and mediated for him before the group, saying, "Forgive the young man this one time, and if he resorts to corruption again, you should expel him from your town." Later, the wise man returned to the same neighborhood and heard a voice crying behind a door. He thought that the young man has been expelled from the town due to his corruptions, and his mother was crying in his absence. He knocked at the door, and the young man's mother opened it. The wise man asked about the woman's son. The woman replied, "He has died, but his death was not an ordinary one. When death approached, he said, 'Do not inform the neighbors of my death. I have annoyed them immensely, and they have reproached me much. I don't want them to be present on my body. Wash and shroud my body yourself and bury this ring with me. I have just bought it, and Bismillahirrahmanirrahim is written on it. Ask Allah to forgive me while you stand beside my grave.' And the mother said that I did what he asked me to do, and when I was returning from his grave, it was as if I heard him saying, 'Go and relax, mother, because I have met the generous.' May the Almighty Allah embody all of us in his specific mercy and keep us on the right path afterwards. Thank you for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh."
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you because you are
a Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you.
From Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, brothers and sisters. Thank you so very much for joining us on today's special episode of Muslim Lady, brought to you by IRIB English Radio. I am your humble host, Zainab, and in the studio with me, I have Sister Razia Shamani. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, my friend, Zainab.
Fatimah al-Ma'asuma's character motivates us to reach our higher potentials, but especially as women. And to me, when I look at Sayyidina Fatima al-Ma'asuma, whether it was during her life or after her death, which was like her life was really short. She only lived 28 years, almost as old as I am now. And but I think she is she's a very good example of how Islam, in its truer form, in its essence, is an ideology that really and actually empowered women.
Mm-hmm.
She's one of the greatest instances of that.
Exactly.
Whether it was throughout her life, the way her father interacted with her, the way her brother interacted with her, the way the men in her family, which were imams, and they were ma'asumin, they were infallible, they acknowledged her abilities, her knowledge, her piety, her great status with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. They entrusted her with so many responsibilities. They believed in her abilities to such a high extent. And then after her death, we just went crazy for her. You know, we built this huge shrine, and so many of our scholars drew inspiration from her and were hoped to be buried in her threshold. And I think that's just so awesome.
It's an honor, actually, to live in the city where her shrine is.
Really, there is.
And a lot, as you said, a lot of the scholars, whenever they had any scientific problems, like they had a question and they couldn't solve it, they would come to her shrine. Or if they had like any material, like financial problems, emotional problems, they wanted wives, they wanted houses, they wanted more knowledge. One of the scholars says that, like, Sadrul Muta'allihin Shirazi, or Mullah Sadra, his house is in Kahak, like about 50, 60 kilometers away from Qom. He says that whenever I have I had a philosophical question, I would come to Bibi Masuma and I would actually ask her. And when you go back to the incidents, like where this group comes from another city, when she wasn't even nine at that time. Then she writes, they have their questions. Her father wasn't there, so she writes the answers to their questions. And, like, you find out the immense, the lofty, like, knowledge status that she had.
Exactly.
So no wonder that even now we believe that as Shias, that whenever someone dies, like the shuhada, those who die in the path of God, they are still alive, and we can get a lot of blessings and bounties from them through the connection that we can have with God through them, mm-hmm. you know? Something that I really want to know more about is that, like, the city that she went to when on her trip from Medina to the city of Marv, mm-hmm. all the way to Save, really we don't know what happened,
exactly.
like what caused her to become so ill and then to stop in Save, like, and then I really want to know how she interacted with the Muslims and with the non-Muslims on this journey, because it took like a really long time.
Exactly.
This is something that I've been wishing to know more about.
Mm.
And also about her personality. The 7 days that she was in Qom, what did she do?
I read an account where during that time
The 7 days you're talking
about? Yeah. During those 7 days that she spent in Qom, she was very ill.
Mm.
And that perhaps one of the possibilities was that she was poisoned during the time that she was in Save after all her brothers were assassinated. They were ambushed, right, by the Abbasid mercenaries or army or whatever. And then she was poisoned, and because she found her death to be impending mm-hmm. and she needed, like, a safe place for herself and the remaining women that were with her,
mm-hmm.
she asked to be brought to Qom because she had heard from her forefathers that Qom is a sanctuary for the Shias of the Ahlul Bayt. And there's a hadith from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam too, right? That there's a haram for Allah, and there's a haram for Rasulullah, haram for Amir, and there's a haram for us, and it's Qom. She was brought here, and then she fell ill.
Yeah.
She fell ill, and she was bedridden, and they were nursing her for a while until she finally passed away.
Yeah. And there's actually, like, there's a special house in Qom that is called Bayt al-Nur, where they...
The House of Light.
That's pretty. Where they, like, they say that she's been worshipping throughout these seven days. But I'm sure that based on the fact that the Ash'aris, they invited her to come to their house, and they knew her high status, definitely respecting her family, like the Alawis and Imam Ridha alayhi salam, you know, knowing his real position as the imam of their time, definitely they would have visited her during this time and asked her questions.
Yeah. I'm not very sure because I have a very faulty memory, but I think she did that as well for the women who came to nurse her and to take care of her and stuff like that. They would come and ask her a question, and she would explain tafasir and ahadith. Yeah, she was a great narrator of ahadith. One of the women, they carried out the hadith of Silsilat al-Dhahab. And the hadith of Ghadir al-Khum is Sayyidah Fatimah al-Masumah alayhi salam. That was her mission through her journey from Medina till her assumed destination, which she never got to reach. And, you know, the fact that she was able to answer those questions at such a young age, and again was given, entrusted with such a huge responsibility of carrying out the message and the rasala of Imam al-Ridha alayhi salam, and exploiting the schemes and the plot of the Abbasid caliphs. Because people are assuming that, oh, Imam al-Ridha is siding with Ma'mun, and now he wants to be Ma'mun's, like, heir apparent, and Imam al-Ridha has just gotten corrupted, and this and that. She needed to explain to people that no, that's not the deal. He's been held there against his will. Shows that in Islam, or in the Sunnah, the real tradition, lifestyle of the Imams, alayhim as-salam, they see just as much potential in their daughters as they did in their sons.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that Imam al-Kadhim and Imam al-Ridha invested so much in Sayyidah Masuma, they put time and energy and effort to raise her, to train her, to teach her, to help her reach her potentials, just shows that, you know, to an extent, women probably can do everything a man can do. Well, sure, she didn't pick up a sword and fight people off, but in terms of intelligence, intellect, spiritual wayfaring, reaching those utmost highest levels of humanity, there's literally no difference between a man and a woman.
actually, sometimes a woman can transcend a man in terms of spiritual status and her faith and everything, because I remember a beautiful hadith from Imam Mahdi Ajalallah Ta'ala Farajah al-Sharif, where he says, verily, in the daughter of the noble prophet, sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam, Fatima, there is a very good role model for all of us. And this is, we're not like talking about a random guy in the street. It's like exactly. A Masum guy, a Masum imam. And or when we're talking about Asiya,
mm-hmm.
or the other ladies that are mentioned in the Quran, and the Quran specifically states that they are role models for men and women, and it's not like, you know, women, first of all, they can reach really high status. And some people like say, yeah, women are very good role models for other women.
Mm.
You know, somehow trying to like degrade them to some extent.
Mm.
But very explicitly, we have it in the Quran and in the narrations that women can be role models for men and women. And this is something that you don't have to like, being a role model, you don't necessarily have to be physically present or physically like very displaying yourself or, you know, like your existence
mm.
through your words, through your actions. You can do that. Just as Lady Khadija, salamullah alayha, that after her marriage, like prior to her marriage with the noble prophet, she was a merchant that whom had like other representers.
Mm.
Agents doing business on her behalf. Her very smart choice selection mm. of these agents showed her how smart she was and how talented and her high managerial skill, that you're able to have hands outside of your home, you know, send them to other continents, other cities, other countries,
mm.
and to bring back to you a lot of profit.
Exactly.
What does this show? That you don't necessarily have to go out in the public and like shout to people that, hey, I'm here, I can do managing stuff. Like, this is something that the Western media has been really, really trying to like feed women's minds, that you have to be the super girl, where you have to like go there, wear tight clothes, flashy like makeup, have a good certain amount of, you know, like there's a standard for how you should, the way your body has to be, right? But the Islamic perspective is something quite different with how, you know, the version of the Islamic empowered woman is very different from the Western secular version of the unempowered, successful.
Exactly.
Woman, right?
When it came down to it, there was still room, or there was no objection to a woman getting out there and getting things done.
Right, when it's necessary.
Yeah. Again, Sayyidah Masuma sallallahu alayha is a great example for that. Or Sayyidah Zainab sallallahu alayha, even Fatima al-Zahra sallallahu alayha, yeah. Even Khadija al-Kubra, all of them.
شفیع روز جزایی یا معصوم تو زینب امام رضایی یا معصوم ملیکه ارض و سمایی یا معصوم شفیع روز جزایی
At the end of the day, when the going gets tough, the tough gets going, you know?
Like, and you know, what? I think there's only one, all these ladies, pure ladies, went out only in one. I mean, the reason for their going out and their presence in the public, if you analyze it, you come to one common cause,
mm-hmm.
which is
protecting wilaya.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Other than that, they had their tafsir classes, but for women.
Mm.
They had their like benefactory charity organization, you know, running them, you know, through the city, and they had their own organization. I mean, they were like active women, the mothers of the imams, the daughters of the imam, the sisters of the imams. But the thing is that only in that specific case of protecting the walaya, they all went to the public. Exactly. And they had like a public presentation.
Which really, well, we're out of time, but it brings us to the question that how is the concept of protecting and defending wilaya manifesting in our time and age? At the end of the day, they all had their present ma'asum, right? Who would live for a limited period of time, and if they did not do everything in their power to protect and defend him, he would be oppressed, usurped, and killed, right? So they had a very limited time to come out and do whatever they had to do for wilaya. In any case, that's all the time we have for today's episode of Muslim Lady. Thank you for being with us. Until another salam and greeting, I leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
I know I'm waiting for something to happen to me. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free. I wish that somehow you tell me out aloud that on that day I'll be okay.
Ministry.
Hamas leaders have reportedly warned Egyptian mediators that they would take an important decision regarding the mutual ceasefire in the event Israel continues such unnecessary aggravations by the end of this week. The Palestinian warning came in the wake of the Qataris informing the United Nations and officials in the Biden administration that such a step provokes the Palestinians and pushes towards an explosive situation. The Palestinian message precedes the Egyptians sending invitations to 19 resistance factions to attend high-level meetings in Cairo in the presence of President Mahmoud Abbas to open dialogue between the Palestinian Authority and the resistance factions in Gaza. For the first time, Cairo invites many resistance factions other than Hamas and the Islamic Jihad to attend the dialogues at the request of Hamas, given that all the factions were equal partners in the last battle, despite objections from certain members of the Fatah movement. Meanwhile, Palestinian resistance factions stressed in a joint statement the need to stop all provocations practiced by the occupation in occupied Al-Quds and the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood to stop the aggression against the Palestinian people, to speed up reconstruction, and to lift the siege on Gaza. In the meantime, commander of the southern region in the Israeli occupation forces, Eliezer Toledano, announced that the army was preparing to resume fighting with Hamas again, because apparently what Israel did in the last round of terrorism against Gaza was not enough, adding that the next operation will not end without changing the security reality in Gaza. Adding salt to the injury, right-wing Zionist Jewish groups announced last week that they would redo the flag march they usually did on what they call Jerusalem Day next Thursday, after their provocative march this year was canceled due to heightened tensions. The march is expected to begin at 7 p.m. Al-Quds time on Thursday, June 10, and head through multiple routes towards the Western Wall near the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Israeli occupation forces have reportedly approved the march. However, Palestinian natives have warned that this provocation will only lead to renewed clashes. Welcome to the Middle East stream. I'm Marwa Osman. As Palestinian factions prepare for dialogue in Cairo, the invasive scene in Gaza is becoming more complex, foretelling the possibility of another confrontation again in light of Israel's insistence on pushing the Gaza Strip. While all border crossings have been closed since the last aggression, Israel's obstruction of the Qatari fund into Gaza poured fuel on the fire, calling for a strongly worded message from the resistance, in which it affirmed that unless the funds are released by this week, it will be concerned with taking an important decision regarding the cessation of hostilities. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Julia Qasim, political commentator. Thank you for being with us, Julia. Now, the resistance factions have informed the Egyptian and the international mediators that the continuous Israeli provocations toward Gaza and its besieged citizens who are to benefit from the Qatari fund or the grant, which Israel is blocking, which more than 100,000 Palestinian families will be benefiting from, it will directly mean a push towards an escalation of the situation in Gaza. Do you think that Gaza can handle another round of the Israeli terrorism and violence?
Better question is, can the Zionist entity handle another round of Gazan resistance? And the answer is, it knows that it can't. The ceasefire that was called for was a one-sided ceasefire, with the Zionist entity basically begging for it, especially after basically receiving news that not only was the Zionist entity brought to its knees when the Gazan resistance barely even exhausted their old stockpiles, but the whole resistance axis was prepared to also come in on the condition that Gaza would, of course, invite them. But Israel was just definitely not ready to face like another round of rockets, including 300 rockets total fired at once, 150 alone at Tel Aviv. So it was terrified then. It's still terrified now. It's trying to even put pressure to make sure that the resistance doesn't respond to its provocations. And its provocations that we've seen in the last few weeks, including the attacks on Al-Aqsa, the harassment of Palestinians in Sheikh Jarrah and Silwan. It's trying to kind of push the envelope as far as to make itself look scary, but immediately stops once it realizes that the repercussions in another round of fighting could lead to its demise, most certainly. They released Muhammad and Muna al-Kurd within hours of detaining them, and this is out of fear. 2 days ago, the Zionist entity canceled the military parade, and today they were too afraid to even wave their occupier flags in Jerusalem. So I would say that it is actually Israel that is put on the defensive this time.
Well, Julia, the resistance did vow that if the provocations do not stop by the end of this week, it will take an important decision by stopping or maybe just throwing away any kind of cessation of a fire or ceasefire, mind you now. Last week, Isaac Herzog was elected as the new president of the Zionist entity, and it seems that a new government is on the verge of being formed in the Israeli entity. But is it wise for Netanyahu at this moment to get involved in another round of aggression, which he sees the best, maybe the best boat out of this chaos inside of the Israeli regime?
Yeah, so Netanyahu's regime, Netanyahu and his party specifically, the far-right coalition he attempted to assemble up and push the deal of the century, which failed, the provocations against Lebanon, the attacks on resistance factions in Syria and on the Hashd al-Shaabi in Iraq 2 years ago, those have backfired. So Netanyahu right now in an attempt to shore up legitimacy, especially in the face of a multi-factional coalition of the Zionist entity that's attempting to kind of save face of the entity itself in light of Netanyahu's repeated failures. He's just trying to kind of salvage the little legitimacy that he is attempting to have. He has corruption charges, the collapse of his government and his coalition. So what this is essentially is that, like I said, he knows that he can't really stand a chance militarily or even politically at this point. But it's an attempt to save face, essentially.
Well, during all these developments, we did see an invitation by Cairo for 19 Palestinian factions from the Gaza Strip that took part in the last battle against Gaza. This meeting is supposed to happen in Cairo in the presence of the Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas. And as I told you, most of the factions are invited for the first time in such high-level talks. But some Fatah movement members were vocal about their rejection of such an invitation, meaning a wide-scope invitation allowing all the Palestinian factions in. But is there a chance that these talks might actually be fruitful, given that Abbas still refuses to acknowledge the very last election that happened when Hamas won the elections?
The whole context of the talks reflects the context of the Palestinian resistance and the force on the ground, essentially. So the Palestinian resistance is more united than ever. They have been more united in the face of struggle and in the face of the siege that has last occurred. And it is also clearer than ever that the PA, which is essentially the neo-colonial force, containing Gaza, containing the West Bank at the direction of the occupation, which has collaborated against the Palestinian resistance and the Palestinian people to the benefit of the Zionist occupation, their legitimacy has completely collapsed. And they, just as Israel is more insecure than ever, so is the Palestinian Authority. As a neo-colonial police force that is essentially losing its legitimacy and authority. So see, in the face of a Palestinian resistance that is essentially more unified than ever, it's just clear that these recent remarks and this bitterness by Mahmoud Abbas and the Palestinian Authority reaffirms its lack of stance at all with the Palestinian resistance and with the Palestinian people. And this is something that's consistent.
Well, in the meantime, we had the commander of the southern region of the Israeli occupation forces, his name is Eleazar Toledano, announced that Israel is preparing to resume the fighting against Gaza, and they have in mind that this time they will not allow the security of the resistance to remain intact inside of the Gaza Strip. So we're talking about massacres here, a continuation of the incremental genocide by the Israeli entity against the people of Gaza. Sayyid Nasrallah was very clear. The Secretary General of Hezbollah said in his last appearance that there will be a regional war if the Zionist entity provokes the Palestinian people, whether it is in Gaza or in Al-Quds. But he was very clear, Al-Quds equals a regional war. Do you think that we are on the verge of the biggest war that this region has ever seen?
You know, I think that I'm positive that the Zionist entity's talks right now, you know, it wanting to be provocative, it's just empty talk, essentially, because it understands, and the resistance has made it clear, Yahya Sinwar of Hamas and Sayyid Nasrallah have made it very, very clear, along with other, leaders of the resistance axis, that there is full support and coordination from all members of the resistance axis to the resistance factions in Gaza, and this will be furthered into a complete campaign to liberate Palestine and Al-Aqsa should Israel fall completely through on its provocations and wage another attack of the same nature. We're to see that becoming more clear by the end of this week. But it is definitely clear that the Zionist entity, though they do not want to have any kind of provocations that's going to make them instantly lose, they still kind of want to save face. I mean, the entity begged for a ceasefire just because settlers, were tired of running to bunkers.
Mm-hmm.
So right now, it's just a balance that the Zionist entity is trying to have of saving face and trying to make itself look like it has any legitimacy left, which it doesn't, can ensure any protection of its illegal settlers, which it can't. And the resistance, which is on the verge of victory right now, we can envision victory as Lebanese, as Palestinians. And there is full preparation to achieve it and attain it if mm-hmm. this Zionist entity makes any stupid moves.
Well, it's going to be a very decisive week indeed. Thank you very much, Julia Qasim from Beirut, political commentator, talking to us about the prospects of another ignition of fire between the Palestinians and the Israeli Zionist entity. Thank you very much for being with us. Please stay tuned. Next, we will be talking about Yemen being part of the equation of Al-Quds.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts.
Now, leader of the Ansarullah movement, Sayyid Abdul Malik al-Houthi, announced that the Yemeni people are part of the deterrence equation established by regional resistance in linking the Israeli threat towards al-Quds to a regional war. Sayyid Houthi criticized the Saudi and the Emirati media and their shameful handling of the recent Israeli aggression on Gaza while praising the Iranian position. Sayyid Houthi also identified three steps to attain peace in Yemen: stopping the Saudi aggression, lifting the siege, and ending the occupation. More in this following report.
Leader of Yemen's Ansarullah movement, Sayyid Abdul Malik Badruddin al-Houthi, stressed last week that the Yemenis are part of the Al-Quds formula, as announced by Hezbollah Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrullah, and will be present effectively in the battle against the Zionist entity. Hezbollah Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrullah consecrated, during his speech on the 21st anniversary of Resistance and Liberation Day, a new formula: if Israel tampers with Al-Quds, it will face a regional war. Sayyid Houthi indicated that Hezbollah and the Palestinian resistance were not supported by any Arab or Muslim state except Iran and Syria, highlighting the importance of the recent victory in Gaza. Leader of Yemen's Ansarullah movement then urged Muslim countries to join forces against Israel in order to expel its regime from the occupied West Bank and East Al-Quds and to completely boycott the Tel Aviv regime. The Yemeni leader noted that the pro-Israeli traitors accuse the resistance forces of being Iran's proxy groups, adding that the Tikfiri war launched against them only serves the U.S. and Israel. Meanwhile, Sayyid Houthi stressed that the peaceful solution in Yemen can be reached when the Saudi-led coalition halts its war and blockade on the Yemenis, adding that the Yemeni nation will not give up its right to freedom, independence, and dignity, and will not abandon its struggle against American and Israeli plots. Furthermore, in an indication of positive developments in the ongoing negotiations to stop the Saudi war in Yemen, an Omani delegation arrived in the Yemeni capital Sana'a on a visit, the first of its kind in years, on Saturday. The delegation was accompanied to Sana'a Airport by the spokesman of the Ansarullah resistance movement and the head of the Sana'a negotiating delegation, Muhammad Abdus Salam, on a plane belonging to the Omani Royal Air Force. Upon his arrival at Sana'a Airport, Abdus Salam said that the delegation of the Royal Office came to discuss the situation in Yemen on the basis of the principle of common interests. Abdus Salam noted that the aim of the Omani delegation's visit was to work on advancing the humanitarian situation as well as the peace process.
Now, to discuss this issue with us from Sana'a is Mr. Muhammad Ashami, political commentator. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Muhammad. Now, Sayyid Abdul Malik al-Houthi made it clear that Yemen will be part of the deterrence equation established by Sayyid Hassan Nasrullah in linking the Israeli threat towards al-Quds to a regional war. Are we going to see Yemeni ballistic missiles landing in the occupied territories of Palestine against the Zionist entity?
Israeli occupation forces take those warnings lightly from both Sayyid Nasrullah and Sayyid al-Houthi, and I believe we may see defense operations and ballistic missiles, drone attacks as well, following the Zionist forces from Yemen. The remarks by both leaders reflect a higher improved level of coordination amongst the resistance access, and affirms that Yemen today is a strong integral part of this new equation.
Well, Mr. Mohammed, Sayyid Abdul Malik went on to say that the Saudi and the Emirati media outlets took up a hostile position towards the Palestinian people, and especially the Palestinian resistance factions inside of Gaza who were bombing retaliatory rocket attacks against the Israeli entity, proving their allegiance to the Zionist regime. Sadly, I'm talking about the media and the Persian Arab Gulf states. This strategy was surely part of the normalization process which these states have started with the Zionist entity last year. Do you think this strategy was enough maybe to subdue their citizens into accepting ties with this warmongering entity that committed massacres against the Palestinian people?
We all noticed that both Saudi and the Emirati exerted a very high level of media effort trying to spread their propaganda against Iran and the Palestinian resistance, while covering up also at the same time for the war crimes committed by the Israeli occupation. This in itself can be taken as an indication that there are many people inside Saudi and the UAE who do not probably buy into this narration, Zionist Arab version of the narration, especially following the resistance latest victory in Gaza, and the increasing awareness that Iran has been actually at the heart of Palestine, supporting and assisting its resistance. So no, I don't think that people are buying that narration.
Well, something very important happened on Saturday is the landing of Omani plane, on board of which is Omani committee alongside the spokesperson of the Ansarullah movement, which breaks way for serious negotiations and dialogue to end the Saudi war on Yemen. What are your views on this?
The Omani delegation that has just arrived with the head of the national delegation, Mohammed Abdel Salam, they arrived a couple of days back, and they said that they are continuing the discussions they had started in Muscat. Mohammed Abdel Salam did not comment much about it, but he implied in his brief comments that they will be discussing first the humanitarian issues, and hopefully if the coalition is serious about it this time, then this may lead to opening other discussions leading to complete ceasefire and bringing back peace to Yemen. We hope that they are serious about it this time.
Sayyid Abdel Malik al-Houthi did identify three very important steps for peace in Yemen, which includes stopping the Saudi aggression, lifting the blockade and the siege of the Yemeni population, and ending the occupation. He means the Saudi and the Emirati occupation of Yemeni land. Mohammed bin Salman has turned several opportunities down that would have made this halting of an aggression at least somewhat easier than bringing it to this level right now. What is Mohammed bin Salman really counting on that would secure him a political gain, which for the past 6 years he had never been able to attain on the field, in the battlefield of Yemen?
Well, let's agree on one thing first. Saudi has lost its military war in Yemen. On the other hand, Yemen counterattacks are becoming more severe, more frequent, and more painful. So what are the options for Saudi? Causing maximum humanitarian damage to 30 million people, and that's what they are trying to do. They use that to negotiate military terms. For example, they say, okay, we will release you some of the fuel vessels, provided you stop advancing towards Marib, which is ridiculous. Sayyid Abdel Malik met the UN representative, Mr. Martin Griffith, last Sunday, and he warned him against continuing to exploit the humanitarian issues of the people. And he affirmed that this will not get them any gains, political gains. And he said that if they continue this, it only means that they are not serious about bringing back peace to Yemen or ending their war.
Well, in the meantime, the Yemeni armed forces are making great advances in the northern governorate of Ma'rib, while also simultaneously achieving groundbreaking reconciliation with many Yemeni tribes in that governorate, which means that less fighting is ahead, which means more reconciliation is to be viewed in the future. How significant do you think the liberation of Ma'rib will be in changing the balance of power in this ongoing Saudi onslaught of Yemen?
It's very important. The liberation of Ma'rib can significantly alter the whole political terrain, and most probably will determine the subsequent outcomes for years to come. The governorate is oil-rich, and it has been used as stronghold by the coalition for their military operations for the past 6-7 years. Losing it means losing a major source of finance. It also means that the forces that are there will be outcasted. There are several mix of mercenary groups that are fighting alongside